دكتور هدى محمودي is the lecturer today in this series. The penultimate, we say? Yes, one before the end? Yes. Dr. Mahmoudi is currently in the research department at the Baha'i World Center in Haifa, Israel. Prior to this appointment, she served as the Dean of the College of Arts and Sciences at the Northeastern Illinois University in Chicago, Illinois. She was also a member of the faculty in the Department of Sociology at the same institution. Prior to her appointment as Dean of at Northeastern Illinois University, Dr. Mahmoudi served as Vice President and Dean of Olivet College, where she was instrumental in the institutional transformation that brought about national recognition to Olivet. Dr. Mahmoudi's scholarly activities include both national and international presentations and publication in the areas of formal organizations, medical sociology, cross-national research, women's studies. She was an invited participant in the Harvard Institute for Educational Management and in the Wharton Institute for Research on Higher Education at the University of Pennsylvania. She holds a PhD in sociology, an MA in educational psychology, and a BA in psychology from the University of Utah. Lecture today, the title of the lecture is Constructiveness and an Accomplishment in Social Relationship, the Baha'i Perspective on Altruism. So please welcome Dr. Mahmoudi, please.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Professor Shafar. Thank you for organizing these wonderful series. It's really a pleasure for me to participate this year. Earlier we were around the refreshment table and I made a comment that I would like to, you know, take one of those whole plates of sweets and eat them, and one of the friends here said, how does that figure for altruistic behavior? And I said, but I'm simply talking about it today, not showing anything in action anyhow. I just wanted to at the outset state that in my paper, there is reference made to words such as man or mankind, and just to state that this is not exclusive language. When that occurs, it really means the generic humankind and includes women as well. Constructing a world commonwealth grounded on obligation and responsibility is not an easy task. The 20th century has shown the capacity for human beings to inflict unimaginable pain, suffering, and destruction upon one another. In terms of social violence, civil violence, mass murder, and genocide, no other century rivals that of the 20th. And it remains to be seen what the 21st century has to offer in this regard. The collapse of communism and the end of the Cold War, rather than bringing an end to ideological battle, seems to have fueled the flames of nationalism, ethnic rivalries, and religious hatreds, thus bringing to surface, in its extreme form, the terror and ugly face of ethnic cleansing. At any given time around the globe, countless in unimaginable atrocities are continually inflicted by one group of human beings upon another. In fact, an assessment of the current global community cannot help but conclude that at the early stages of the 21st century, humanity, rather than acting on the reality of its interdependence and the need for collaboration, is instead pursuing a course that impedes the possibility of building bonds of cooperation and peaceful existence, and appears to be on the brink of total disorder and chaos. As the forces of globalization continue to unfold, the world community finds itself in a quagmire of growing political instability, intense economic inequality, and the weakening of family, educational, and religious authority. Never before in history have the wide-ranging, diverse peoples and cultures of the planet lived in such close proximity to one another. And yet, within this global community, deep attitudes of suspicion, distrust, and hatred persist among its diverse populations. Those engaged in the study of cultures have, on the one hand, pointed to multiculturalism as a means for democratic society to recognize and promote equal representation of all, including equal access to economic means. But multiculturalism is challenged by deep-rooted prejudices and attitudes of superiority and control among certain groups or cultures that actively impede possibilities of removing barriers, resolving differences, and promoting advancement towards coexistence. Others view the emerging global community as one wherein the clash of civilizations or conflict between cultures is inevitable. In particular, Samuel P. Huntington views the post-Cold War era as one in which cultural identities are shaping the patterns of cohesion, disintegration, and conflict. Huntington describes this new world order, quote, "In the post-Cold War world, flags count, and so do other symbols of cultural identity, including crosses, crescents, and even head coverings, because culture counts. And cultural identity is what is most meaningful to most people. People are discovering new but old identities and marching under new but often old flags, which lead to wars with new but often old enemies." For many, modernity and its initial optimism and promise for a better, more advanced economic system and rationalization and organization is viewed as a failed experiment. Many critics believe that modern society is incapable of resolving its very basic social ills, much less the more complex global uncertainties that challenge humankind to search for new paradigms of international life and civil organization and governance. Sociologist Robert Bella describes this seeming impotence of the modern age, and I quote, "There is a widespread feeling that the promise of the modern era is slipping away from us. A movement of enlightenment and liberation that was to have freed us from superstition and tyranny has led in the 20th century to a world in which ideological fanaticism and political oppression have reached extremes unknown in previous history." Mary Ann Glendon, in her book, The Seedbeds of Virtue, points out how in postmodern academy, words like virtue and character have nearly disappeared from the lexicon of the modern human sciences. Others have observed a decline in public morality as democratic societies have spread, as growth of prosperity has occurred, and as personal freedom has expanded. Jonathan Sacks, in his book, The Dignity of Difference, How to Avoid the Clash of Civilizations, suggests that the current conflict-ridden global community is in need of common values that promote coexistence if we are to avoid the clash of civilizations. Just to quote a part of what he suggests, he says, "The human project is inescapably a moral project." That is one reason why the great faiths, with their history of reflection on moral issues, must be part of the conversation. Sociologist Philip Selznick defines modernity as referring to the special features of the technologically advanced industrial, commercial, and urban society that has taken shape in the West since the 18th century, anticipated, of course, by earlier trends and ideas. He presents a more constructive perspective on modern life by suggesting that, and I quote, "Modern life offers a welcome, if risky, challenge to the moral order. As self-determination is enlarged, as awareness is sharpened, the complexity of moral choice increases. The responsibility of individuals and groups becomes in many ways more self-conscious and more demanding. More is asked of us, and we ask more of ourselves." In late 20th century, postmodernism emerged as a reaction to modernity. rejecting scientific objectivity, challenging the notion of coherence, and refuting the existence of any authoritative principles. Postmodernism rejects any form of truth, whether philosophical, scientific, or religious. Philip Selznick, in his discussion of the challenge of postmodernism, points to its validity in relation to the many insidious aspects of modern life, including hidden forms of power and manipulation. He refers to postmodernism as a wayward child of modernism and suggests that its central message carries the logic of modernism to its farthest reaches. And he elaborates on this point in the following statement. It does so without retaining the intellectual, moral, and aesthetic strengths of modernism, without the belief that there is genuine truth to be discerned, without confidence in the possibility of creating a new and a better way of manifesting the human spirit, without tacit commitment to continuity as well as change. What there was of exuberant optimism has been displaced by cynicism and despair with postmodernism. With some fidelity, postmodern theorists reflect and dramatize the weakening of selfhood in late modernity. New ideologies continue to emerge, some with the goal of providing, on the one hand, solutions to social ills presently at work throughout the world, and on the other hand, with grim explanations of the failure of any form of intervention that might be the source of remedy for the many global disorders. The unparalleled levels of violence, the proliferation of political corruption, the increased lawlessness, the breakdown in the code of ethics, and the lax attitude towards ecological disintegration, the overall disregard for human rights, all such disorders seem to have brought humanity to its darkest hour. It is no wonder that the individual response to such dreadful developments is one of a paralysis of will, a sense of deep pessimism and profound disaffection. At the heart of the current predicament that a beleaguered global community finds itself in are complex questions about the future and direction of humankind, about the role of the individual, and above all, the whole collective nature of society and the possibilities that might be available to human beings. Is it possible, one asks, for humans to find a common vision in advancing reasonable solutions to the present course of disintegration? Who can or should take responsibility for reversing the present bleak condition faced by humankind? In this paper, I try to examine the challenging pronouncements that have been advanced by Baha'u'llah, the prophet founder of the Baha'i faith, regarding the need for humankind in the present age to recognize and bring about a world community founded on the unification of the human race and the establishment of a new world order that is responsive to the needs of a single human race. The paper discusses the teachings of the Baha'i faith that address the establishment of, and I quote, constructive social forces which, because they are consistent with human nature, will encourage harmony and cooperation instead of war and conflict. Very much cognizant of the capacity of human beings to inflict great harm on each other, but also cognizant of the fact that human beings can also do great good, the paper examines what it means to be a human from the spiritual framework as set forth in the Baha'i writings. It discusses the potential of the development of the spiritual qualities through moral education that lead to individual and institutional actions within the Baha'i community, which aim to promote the welfare of others as being more important than one's own, thus developing the Baha'i concept of reciprocity or altruism as providing a foundation for the formation of a society centered on constructiveness and accomplishment in all the planes of human society. Now, throughout the paper, I will make reference to the Baha'i teachings. These are contained in the writings of the religion's prophet founder, Baha'u'llah, his son and successor, Abdul Baha, and Abdul Baha's grandson and successor, Shoghi Effendi. Baha'is accept these works as authoritative texts and the definitive model for belief and behavior, as well as the blueprint for social transformation and for the global social order that is the ultimate goal of the Baha'i faith. In the middle of the 19th century, Baha'u'llah, a prophet founder of a new independent world religion, imparted his vision of the oneness of humankind and the earth as one common homeland. In the 1960s, while an exile of the Ottoman Empire, Baha'u'llah wrote about the need for the creation of a new world order, stating that, quote, "The winds of despair are alas blowing from every direction, and the strife that divides and afflicts the human race is daily increasing. The signs of impending convulsions and chaos can now be discerned, inasmuch as the prevailing order appears to be lamentably defective. Soon will the present day order be rolled up and a new one spread in its stead." Shoghi Effendi, the great grandson of Baha'u'llah, wrote that dark forces of hate, rebellion, anarchy, and reaction are threatening the very stability of human society. He expounded on the need for a new system, a world order, as set forth by Baha'u'llah, and set into motion a plan for the development toward the organization of an emerging global community. In 1936, Shoghi Effendi, writing about the disorder facing humanity and the need for its unification, wrote, "Beset on every side by the cumulative evidences of disintegration, of turmoil, and of bankruptcy, serious-minded men and women in almost every walk of life are beginning to doubt whether society, as it is now organized, can, through its unaided efforts, extricate itself from the slough into which it is steadily sinking. Every system short of the unification of the human race has been tried, repeatedly tried, and been found wanting." Now, I'd like to just explain briefly for the next little while the basic tenets of the Baha'i religion, which I think lead to this concept of creating altruism and constructiveness in social relationships, because without these fundamental concepts, I think it would be difficult to make the jump towards altruistic behavior. A large segment of Baha'u'llah's writings are dedicated to the progressive nature of God's revelation and man's relationship to it. There is only one God, described by Baha'u'llah as an unknowable essence, exalted beyond every human attribute. It is through the will of God, this unknowable essence, that successive revelations or religions are made known to humanity. The Baha'i teachings view divine revelation not as a static, unique event, but as a continuing process that is the central feature of human history. There is only one religion, that there has been and will continue to be prophets who introduce humankind to God's progressive revelation does not imply that religion is in competition with itself. Prophets, or manifestations of God, appear because humanity is in need of spiritual renewal. With every new revelation, a new prophet appears with a twofold purpose, and Baha'u'llah describes these as, first, to liberate the children of men from the darkness of ignorance and guide them to the light of true understanding, and the second to ensure the peace and tranquility of mankind and provide all the means by which they can be established. According to Baha'u'llah, the first step toward the establishment of peace begins with the acceptance then of the principle of the oneness of the human race, a global community wherein all its inhabitants recognize and accept their membership in one human family. Shoghi Effendi explains that the coming of the age of the human race is associated with the unification of the human race, which will evolve into the stage at which the oneness of the whole body of nations will be made the ruling principle of international life. Baha'u'llah's vision of the emerging international community calls for a widening of the existing foundations of society. It asks for the reshaping of institutions in order that they be in harmony with what he refers to as the needs of an ever-changing world. And Shoghi Effendi summarizes what Baha'u'llah foreshadowed for the evolving global society in the following passage. Unification of whole of mankind is the hallmark of the stage which humanity is now approaching. Unity of family, of tribe, of city-state, and nation have been successively attempted and fully established. World unity is the goal towards which a harassed humanity is striving. Nation building has come to an end. The anarchy inherent in state sovereignty is moving towards a climax. A world growing to maturity must abandon this fetish, recognize that the oneness and wholeness of human relationships, and establish ones for all the machinery that can best incarnate this fundamental principle of its life. So this is the vision that is put forth in Baha'u'llah's writing. And the question then arises as to how the Baha'i faith envisages the development of such a system. In particular, what is the role of the individual and the role of Baha'i institutions in constructing a social life that's based on the unification of humankind living in an interdependent world? And how is such a system possible given the present dark or moribund condition that the world community is facing? And as a result, is it possible to bring about cooperation and constructiveness or altruistic behavior in social relationships? The Baha'i faith addresses the development of social patterns that are necessary for the well-being of humankind and for its advancement. For the individual Baha'i, personal commitment to the laws and principles of Baha'u'llah is the key to transforming oneself, which leads to the transformation of civilization. One's inner life and attitude cannot be separated from one's public life. The ethics and values that guide the individual are not separate from the rest of society. And I'd like to read this concept as defined it's elaborated on by Shoghi Effendi, this interconnectedness between the individual and society. He writes, "We cannot segregate the human heart from the environment outside and say, once one of these is reformed, everything will be improved. Man is organic with the world. His inner life molds the environment and is itself also deeply affected by it. The one acts upon the other, and every abiding change in the life of man is the result of these mutual reactions." Baha'i teachings shift the focus of religious practice from individual salvation or enlightenment to the collective responsibility for the progress of humanity as a whole. The Baha'i conception of social life is essentially based on the subordination of the individual will to that of society. Baha'i teachings address social conditions and global problems as directly related to the individual's spiritual life. Baha'i principles such as world peace, equality of men and women, harmony between science and religion, the equitable distribution of wealth and resources, and the elimination of all forms of prejudice for Baha'is are inseparable from religious belief and practice. This emphasis on collective progress has important implications for the relationship of individual entities, whether individual persons, institutions, nations, or other groups. Because the individual entity to the larger society of which they are a part of, Shoghi Effendi describes that the relationship between these entities is based on the principle of the subordination of every particularistic interest, be it personal, regional, national, to the paramount interests of humanity. This in turn is based on the idea that a world of interdependent peoples and nations, that in such a world where there is such deep interdependence between people and nations, the advantage of the part is best to be reached by the advantage of the whole. Yet the interests of humanity as a whole are not conceived in terms of vague abstraction that could be appropriated by a particular dominant group and interpreted as identical with its own interests, but rather as a complex dynamic relationship between the parts and the whole, in which the viability of the whole is served by ensuring the well-being of all its individual parts. And this is an enterprise that everyone shares responsibility for. This conception is demonstrated at its most basic level in the relationship of the individual person and society. There's a complex balance between individual freedom and responsibility. Cooperation between society and the individual is stressed in the Baha'i teachings, as is the fostering of a climate in which the untold potentialities of every and each individual member of society can develop. Such a relationship, as it is envisioned, must allow free scope for individuality to assert itself through modes of spontaneity, initiative, and diversity that ensures the viability of society. Even while the will of the individual is subordinate to that of the society, the individual is not lost in the mass, but becomes the focus of primary development. So the fundamental principle of social relations and structures for Baha'is lies in the realization of belief and practice. The fulfillment of individual potential is to be sought not in pursuing self-centered desires, but in contributing to the betterment and well-being of others, and in the belief that the honor and distinction of the individual consists in this, that he, among all the world's multitudes, should be a source of social good. This challenging assertion, as put forth in the Baha'i teachings, cannot be fully understood without an examination of the Baha'i perspective of what it means to be a human being and what is the purpose of life for humans. Again, I can't go into too much detail, but I'd like to start out just briefly talking about the dual nature of human beings, which is discussed in the Baha'i teachings, and how human beings, although they have this dual nature, they are different from animals. And I'd like to talk briefly about the differences. In the Baha'i writings, the differences between human beings and animals are described actually at length. Animals are referred to as captives of the senses. They do not have the power of ideation or conscious reflection. Animals are without education and training, have no touch with the spiritual world, and are without the conception of God. And yet, animals are described as being keener than humans when it comes to bodily senses. Animals manifest superiority to humans in their powers such as hearing, sight, smell, taste, and touch, but they are unable to perceive intellectual realities. And so from the Baha'i perspective, what sets human beings apart from animals is the human spirit, the mind, or if you will, the rational soul. This is unique to humans and is absent in the world of nature, according to Baha'i teachings. Abdu'l-Bahá explains this in the following passage. When you wish to reflect upon or consider a matter, you consult something within you. You say, shall I do it or shall I not do it? Is it better to make this journey or abandon it? Whom do you consult? Who is within you deciding this question? Surely there is a distinct power, an intelligent ego. Were it not distinct from your ego, you would not be consulting it. It is greater than the faculty of thought. It is your spirit which teaches you, which advises and decides upon matters. But Abdu'l-Bahá also says that this duality of the human being involves, in other words, the spirit of man has two aspects. One divine, one satanic. That is to say that human beings are capable of utmost perfection, but they are also capable of utmost imperfection. So it's this duality that I think is important for us to consider as we examine the Baha'i spiritual principles and move towards altruistic tendencies. So Baha'is believe that that human beings have the capacity to do both good and evil. But there is more attention and deliberate attention that needs to be paid to goodness and to overcoming the evil. In other words, Shoghi Effendi says, evil exists and we cannot close our eyes to it, even though it is a negative existence. We must seek to supplant it by good. Baha'is believe that it's spiritual education that is the way and means by which this can be achieved. The other thing I'd like to say about being a human being has to do with the Baha'i viewpoint of human nature. Why human beings? Why are they here? And I'd like to read a quote from Baha'u'llah, which I think defines this best. Having created the world and all that liveth and moveth therein, God, through the direct operation of his unconstrained and sovereign will, chose to confer upon man the unique distinction and capacity to know him and to love him. A capacity that must needs be regarded as the generating impulse and the primary purpose underlying the whole of creation. This distinction, unique distinction bestowed upon the human being confers responsibility and capacity for cultivating of the spiritual virtues in the service of the collective advancement of society. The individual is expressed in quite lofty expressions in the Baha'i writings. Baha'u'llah says that every individual should become the source of all goodness, in his words, I'm quoting, source of all goodness and an example of uprightness to mankind. He writes, noble have I created thee, yet thou hast abased thyself. Rise then for that which thou was created. The Baha'i teachings insist that the individual has the capacity to leave behind the outdated traditions, prejudices, superstitions, narrow-mindedness, and provincial tendencies that keep humanity apart because of these spiritual attributes that the Baha'i teachings say the human beings are endowed with. And so Baha'i teachings invite the individual to acquire a world-embracing vision that accepts the equality, the well-being, and oneness of all people. Now I'd like to move on briefly to the arena of moral education or spiritual education and how that also plays a very important role in the transformation of the individual. As you can tell from the Baha'i perspective, then, human beings are fundamentally spiritual. And that becomes extremely important to this, the focus of this paper. developing the spiritual side is a comprehensive, lifelong process. The Baha'i writings are quite realistic rather than Pollyannish in their assessment of the capacity of humans to pursue selfish motives or to inflict great harm upon others. But they are also quite clear about the human capacity to rise above these tendencies. Just to quote what Abdu'l-Bahá says, he says, it's impossible for a human being to turn aside from his own selfish advantages and sacrifice his own good for the good of the community, except through true religious faith. So this is how Baha'is believe that the selfish qualities must be overcome, is by being other-directed and through the spiritual or moral virtues. In this regard, the Baha'i teachings on spiritual education focus on the socialization or training of children. This is a very important aspect of how to internalize spiritual teachings through the training of children from a very young age. In fact, the Baha'i teachings say, train them in goodly character and good morals. Guide them to all the virtues of humankind. In one place they say, training in morals and good conduct is far more important than book learning, something that my son enjoys pointing out to me. And Abdu'l-Bahá explains the reason for this, the reason for training in morals and good conduct is this, that the child who conducts himself well, even though he be ignorant, is of benefit to others, while an ill-natured, ill-behaved child is corrupt and harmful to others, even though he be learned. If, however, a child is trained to both learned and good, the result is light upon light. So Baha'i child socialization aims to develop a pro-social. Pro-social is a term used in altruistic literature, a pro-social orientation. That is, an orientation which implies that in social actions, traits such as helping, sharing, and caring are valued. Children are taught to appreciate the principle of unity in diversity, which implies that all people, regardless of race, class, nationality, ethnicity, whatever the background, that all of humanity is accepted and should be befriended and should be appreciated. So it's this concept of unity and diversity that respect for others becomes very important. As adult Baha'is, this socialization does not stop. In fact, there is a commitment to a continued internalization of these patterns until they become the foundation of the personality itself. So this spiritual development is seen as an infinite process of self-transformation. It's continual, it's conscious. And the cultivation of spiritual altruistic qualities then remains the aim and the central focus of the life for the adult Baha'i. Now I'd like to then spend the rest of the time talking about how we promote altruism, or what I would refer to as promoting the welfare of others, or considering the welfare of others as more important than one's own. I've talked about how human beings have brought the current situation, the current problems in the world, to a level at which we are really living in very dark times, in very difficult times. But I'd like to suggest that if we are responsible for bringing humanity to this level, we too have the responsibility to do something about it, rather than to just throw up our hands and say, this is the way it's going to be forever. Baha'u'llah describes that religion has a very important role to play, as I've been saying throughout this presentation, in regard to this transformation and in moving towards relationships among human beings that are about cooperation and altruism. But Baha'u'llah also points out that as good as religion can be in promoting these tendencies, religion can also be a source of great harm and great disunity. He says the weakening of the pillars of religion hath strengthened the hands of the ignorant and made them bold and arrogant. On the other hand, he says religion is the greatest of all means for the establishment of order in the world and for the peaceful contentment of all that dwell therein. So that religion has the capacity for the advancement of a moral order, but it's one that has to be worked at and constantly developed. In fact, in another place, Shoghi Effendi says the chief reason for the evils now rampant in society is lack of spirituality. So how do Baha'is view reciprocity or altruism, and as I said, cooperation in relationships? First of all, social relationships, and I'd like to look at this a little bit from the sociological perspectives, and I'm getting close to finishing, and I think I'll be on time, Mr. Chairperson. Social relationships involve requirements that must be met if groups are to survive and flourish. Selznick believes that these requirements include leadership, communication, specialization, and symbolic affirmation of group identity. But then there are other requirements that generate moral obligations, such as maintaining order, protecting property, and facilitating cooperation. As an example of such obligations, I'd like to quote what Selznick says. He says, a norm of reciprocity, that is, people should help those who have helped them, and people should not injure those who have helped them, is in one form or another universally recognized. Such principles are not accidental developments, he writes. They are solutions to problems, rediscovered innumerable times as ways of dealing with ever-present demands of organization and solidarity. So, from the Baha'i perspective, the evolution of a moral order is described in language that places significant responsibility back on the individual, and that the individual has to continually strive to distinguish between good and bad, or good and evil. In one place, Baha'u'llah writes, the betterment of the world can be accomplished through pure and goodly deeds, through commendable and seemly conduct. In other places, the Baha'i writings talk about how human beings should adorn their characters with trustworthiness and godliness, and with such qualities as are conducive to the elevation of man's station in the world of being. So, reciprocity is a concept that is highly valued in the Baha'i teachings. It is one of the principles that aims to bring about true altruistic intentions in social interactions. It is an integral part of a system of social exchange or giving back. It strives to bring solidarity and a sense of duty to others. In the social sciences, altruism is defined as unselfish regard for or devotion to the welfare of others. It is considered to be a highly multifaceted concept, and I'd like to quote from Samuel and Carl Olliner, who in their book, The Altruistic Personality, Rescuers of Jews in Nazi Europe, wrote about that the act of altruism needs to be performed entirely for its own sake, apart from any considerations of self-satisfaction, pleasure, or utility. Thus, self-interest is an inherent trait of human beings, that self-interest is an inherent trait of human beings, according to the Olliners, is challenged. And the notion that human behavior can be motivated by self-transcendence is actually upheld in altruistic literature. Sociologists Helen Fine, who has done amazing research in the area of genocide and has provided amazing insights into this area as well as the area of altruism, suggests a theory of collective altruism, where she says that the altruistic people view those they help as individuals, as members, not of a strange. Universe of obligation. For the altruistic person, Helen Fine writes, there is no other. Identification with the other as other tends to be self-annulling. For as one begins to identify and internalizes the role of the other, he or she is no longer perceived as the other, but simply as a fellow human. Two types of altruistic behavior are described in the literature: universalistic or inclusive, and specialized or bounded. Philosopher Lawrence Bloom has written that the more inclusive the altruistic behavior, the more worth it has. Just quickly, the specialized or bounded altruism simply means that it's an ethic of commitment to individuals because of their belonging to one's family or to one's group. Okay, whereas universalism or inclusive altruism is defined as reaching out to people who are part of the larger group, In other words, there's no separation between one's family and one's group versus all of humanity or all people. So it's a kinship with all people that's important in the second form of altruism, the universalistic. The Baha'i perspective is clearly aligned with the inclusive or universal form of altruism based on the oneness of humankind, viewing humanity as one family, seeing no conflict between religion, etc. Abdu'l-Bahá says regarding this whole topic of altruism, he says, the supreme need of humanity is cooperation and reciprocity. The stronger the ties of fellowship and solidarity amongst men, the greater will be the power of constructiveness and accomplishment in all the planes of human activity. Without cooperation and reciprocal attitude, the individual member of human society remains self-centered, uninspired by altruistic purposes, limited and solitary in development, like the animal and plant organisms of the lower kingdom. Elsewhere in the Baha'i writings, altruistic norms are explicitly delineated, holding in high regard those who, and I quote from the Baha'i teachings, those who nurture altruistic aims and plans for the well-being of their fellow men. Other teachings reflect the values and attitudes conducive to an altruistic orientation, including a sense of unity with and responsibility towards others beyond one's own social group, emphasis on relationship rather than status, generosity, trustworthiness, appreciation of diversity, as well as an ethical value of justice and caring. It is noteworthy that both the ethical principles of justice and caring, important motivators of altruistic behavior, are emphasized in Baha'i writings, where they are not viewed as contradictory or exclusive, but as inseparably connected. Even when the ethic of justice is enjoined, it is usually as a practice to be performed out of concern for others. Justice is presented as the practice of equity, often linked with safeguarding the rights of the downtrodden. The Baha'i conception of justice means that all have the right to receive care and for justice. Well over a half a century ago, before Carol Gilligan, who wrote the book In a Different Voice regarding women's moral development, before she called attention to the complementarity of the masculine ethic of justice and the feminine ethic of caring, it's interesting to note that Abdu'l-Bahá wrote, and I quote him, "The kingdom of God is bounded upon equity and justice, and also upon mercy, compassion, kindness to every living soul. Strive ye then with all your heart to treat compassionately all humankind." But then he warns that kindness cannot be shown the tyrant, the deceiver, or the thief, because it makes them to continue in their perversity as before. So again, there are conditions. Now, Baha'i institutions also promote altruistic behavior. As I've talked so far about individual transformation, I'd like to spend the rest of the time discussing briefly how the Baha'i institutions promote this principle. As you know, we need a social context in which to be able to develop a collective movement towards whatever the goal might be, and in this case, altruistic behavior. Because it's in this collective or social context that norms evolve, and hence a culture evolves that can be altruistic. And I think there is great research that draws on the importance of group norms in motivating moral behavior. I would like to just quote from Sam and Pearl Oliner again, where they talk about a normocentric orientation in motivating the altruistic behavior of rescuers of Jews during World War II. And by normocentric, they say a normocentric reaction is not rooted in direct connection with the victim, but rather in a feeling of obligation to a social reference group with whom the actor identifies and whose explicit and implicit rules he feels obliged to obey. Such findings imply that not only must altruistic qualities be fostered in individuals, but a social framework must also be provided within which extensivity and altruism are highly valued and represent the norms of the group itself. The creation of such a society is inseparable from the development of individual altruistic personalities. For so long as groups value negative aspects such as ethnocentrism, egocentrism, unfettered individualism, status seeking, dominance, any of these negative aspects, then altruistic personality will appear as an aberrant or an anomaly in comparison with the rest of the group. In Baha'i society, this situation is reversed. Altruism is not an aberrant behavior, contrary to convention, because the normative expectations which individuals are ultimately expected to internalize are altruistic. Quickly, Baha'i institutions are elected annually by secret ballot and with plurality of vote. In Baha'i communities by adult members of the community. I'm just talking about the process so you have a picture of what it looks like. These institutions are at the local level, the regional, the national, and the international level. These institutions primarily, just to tell you a little bit about their range of governance, they promote the progress and development of the community through the application of spiritual principles and laws. In other words, it's the spirit of Baha'u'llah's teachings that must permeate and manifest itself through these institutions. Among their responsibilities are educational programs for children and adults, community devotional meetings, application and observance of Baha'i laws and principles relevant to the rank and file of its members, and the overall spiritual protection and well-being of the community as it advances towards implementing the goals of the Baha'i religion. Let me just give you a principle that's extremely important to the individuals who serve on these institutions. No single individual in the Baha'i community has authority. It is more of a group consensus building process, which I'll talk about in a minute. The members of these institutions, rather than being responsible to constituencies, are responsible to the principles and laws as put forth by Baha'u'llah. So the framework of how decision making takes place is totally removed from constituency to principles and laws. Now, the principle of unity and diversity, which I mentioned earlier, is extremely important because institutions have a responsibility to promote this. And individuals, of course, as we talked about, also accept the importance of unity and diversity. But most prominent among one of the practices of these institutions is the practice of consultation. A group decision-making process whose goal is to reach solutions to problems by consensus. Baha'i consultation encourages open and frank expression of diverse views on the topic under discussion in an atmosphere of love and respect that also allows the clash of differing opinions that can strike the shining spark of truth. Each member of the consultative group has an equal right of expression And no blocks or factions or any subdivisions of the group are permitted. Inseparable from Baha'i consultation or the consultative process is the development of sensitivity and respect for different voices whose expression of opinion may not fit into conventional or dominant cultural modes of communication. Since the group attempts to work towards consensus on an issue, voting only as a last resort, the process does not necessarily require reduction to duality. Alternatives need not be narrowed down to two poles, for and against. Instead, the consultative process itself, drawing on the interactive contributions of all its diverse members, is looked to as the creative source to new solutions. Consultation is regarded both as a method for generative decision-making and conflict resolution, as well as an instrument for reinforcing the unity of diverse groups. And in the Baha'i community, it is used at all levels, whether it's within one's family, neighborhood, in the workplace. Now, moving on, another way in which Baha'i administrative institutions are structured to implement this unity and diversity towards altruistic tendencies involves guaranteeing of the participation of minority ethnic populations. And the definition of what constitutes a minority is decided upon by the national institution of each country, which is referred to as the National Spiritual Assembly. In Shoghi Effendi's writings, he says, to discriminate against any race on the ground of its being socially backward, politically immature, and numerically in a minority is considered to be a flagrant violation of the spirit of the Baha'i teachings. In principle, protecting the just interests of any minority element within the Baha'i community and ensuring that all have the opportunity to contribute their perspectives to the collaborative efforts of the group is considered so important that representatives of minority populations are not only enabled to enjoy equal rights and privileges, but they are even favored and accorded priority. Baha'i communities are instructed that it is their duty to ensure and to ensure that Baha'i representative institutions, be they assemblies, conventions, committees, conferences, have all the diverse elements, racial or otherwise, represented among them. One way that this is possible is through the principle of the minority tie rule that of Baha'i elections, if there's a tie that involves a minority. In the course of elections, as I said, for these Baha'i institutions, if voting results in a tie between persons, one of whom represents a minority, priority is unhesitatingly given to that person. In fact, there's no voting. There's no voting again to see how to break the tie. In fact, the party that represents the minority not only is accepted as the person, but the person who has tied with the minority without any question accepts that the minority should be the member of the institution. And this, again, is a normative process that shows how Baha'is strive and struggle to come about with these altruistic tendencies. Anyway, I'd like to conclude by saying that whether applied within one's individual life or in community administration, Baha'i principles and practices are viewed as a catalyst whose application will ultimately, as the Baha'i teachings say, bring about social transformation, leading to the development of an altruistic global society. Such a society in the Baha'i context begins with the individual striving daily toward personal transformation, the deliberate internalization of spiritual teachings, incorporating altruistic extensive values as personal norms. The Baha'i teachings strive to imbue individuals with an inclusive orientation, transcending, though not suppressing, other group loyalties, and valuing the well-being of the entire planet and all its inhabitants. Throughout the Baha'i writings, the vision imparted to the individual is that of a peaceful, just, and caring civilization whose foundation rests on the cornerstone of the unity of all human beings, a unity that is to be consolidated and protected by institutions that reflect and promote the principles of equity, unity, altruistic service as normative expectations. As a community whose membership includes individuals from virtually every race, class, nation, ethnicity, and religion, Baha'is are laboring hard to bring about a global community based on constructiveness, altruism in all social relationships. They believe that it is their duty to strive toward the establishment of a moral order in which pernicious aspects of human nature are overcome by the positive, spiritual tendencies inherent in every individual. From the Baha'i perspective, real change towards a cooperative, progressive, global community requires that the spiritual framework of society become strengthened. Nothing, Baha'is believe, short of a legitimate commitment to the fortification of the spiritual nature of humans can hope to bring true and lasting happiness to human existence. Janet and Peter Kahn, in their book, The Advancement of Women, A Baha'i Perspective, explain that to a Baha'i, the ideal spiritual life does not conform to the traditional model of an individual engaged in solitary spiritual discipline, remote from the interaction of other people, and removed from the transactions of social life. Rather, the Baha'i teachings direct attention to the interactive relationship between individual and social development, calling for a holistic approach in which the actions of the individual and of the social organism mutually reinforce each other and give rise to evolutionary change. The Baha'is envision a world commonwealth in which, as described by Shoghi Effendi, the consciousness of world citizenship, the founding of a world civilization and culture will be established. In that civilization, as a result of practical consequences of the spiritualization of the world and the fusion of all its races, creeds, classes, and nations, peace will be established. Thank you very much.
Well, we thank very much Dr. Mahmoudi for a very interesting and I must say, in view of the today's circumstances, quite optimistic and utopic, I would say. But I hope these what you have described here and told, it will be realized even partially. We will be more satisfied in the world, of course. It's something to look forward to.